Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
timeliness in research, sort of understanding what the limitations of a particular area of research is and getting it finished rather than actually seeing it finished as it's actually deployed. So probably one example would possibly be the landing systems in the Boeing's aircraft. They had an idea, and their idea of completing it was actually getting it into the aircraft and deploying it. And that was signing it off, that finished it off. And of course, that had disastrous consequences. But there's this general idea that ideas have to sort of cross the finishing line quickly rather than develop it. So sort of an example might be that you might be decide that a wedding cake, the icing really makes it because that's what people see, the way the light goes in it, and you may work for a long way while producing better icing. It's a key component to making a wedding cake successful, and you know, you can do a logic that, you know, you can actually do an argument where you can describe people being shocked at a poor quality wedding cake. But of course, once it's high quality, you're sort of no one notices it. But say you were developed a better icing, and you'd actually put your effort into that and not looked at the sort of the other ingredient, and then you tell people about that, that's great. They say, look, I want to order a wedding cake for next Tuesday. And of course, you've only developed the icing, and the rest of the stuff, you don't want to rush too fast into getting it going. So this is similarly true to the current research that I'm producing at the moment. And I've read a research paper and discussed some advancements, namely with a chap called Michael, who will look and listen to various things. So he's listening to podcasts and sort of reading research papers. So the general, the sort of generalized idea is that you can actually, in a box, put an Arduino programmable controller, and it can do various things, which allows, rather than you being in the classroom, it allows you to be in the classroom via this Arduino programmer. So the large concept is this box and Arduino programmer, and I've got three boxes on the go at the moment. One is a box with a little jumping duck with it, which allows me to interact with kids, and it's made out of, you know, broken bits from the other projects. Another one is a Einstein pendulum. So this is a quantum mechanics experiment, which is traditionally too hard to do and should demonstrate, but putting it in a box, it is, you know, I've crossed the line, you're able to demonstrate it. And the general concept after this, the next thing is a utility box. That so the these various boxes sort of it's on varying degrees, I've got control of them. So the Einstein boxes, you plug it in and it tells you the frequency, and you can see the oscillation, you can see the bits and pieces. The duck in a box, it's slowly being pushed by the kids to have more interactivity. So there's a capacitive sensor, which I described last night, that you put your finger on a certain part of the box and the duck will begin to dance and various things, and they ask for more and more, and you can sort of see how they interact with it. Then there's this sort of central issue which I'm writing the research paper for, which is the utility box. This is a box with a super sensitive mass scale, which can measure your tripod. You put your Bunsen burner and above the Bunsen burner, you put your tripod, you put your gauze, you put your beaker, and you can zero that and then pour in water and measure the amount of water that you you go in. And once you go to the extent of getting one mass scale and put it onto a Duino board, and the Duino board then puts it, the PLC puts it to an Ethernet, a Wi-Fi chip then that puts it. Once you do that link, there's the floodgates opened. You can then festoon it with 10 temperature gauges. 5 low cost, -55 to 135 degree sensors. And you can arrange them, they're waterproof, they're fairly stable and easy to deploy. And another 5 top of the range thermocouples. They've got very low thermal mass, they've got very high precision, so you could use that. Then the pressure sensors only cost a few dollars each, so everything costs a few dollars, and you can go across here, and this is a device. Now, at a particular point in the build, you realise, this thermocouples are no good, and I've sort of ordered a series of things, and they'll take probably 5 days, 7 days to come out of China. And you're aware that your memory's not as good as because you've got to say, what exactly did I order? But there's sort of several components, and the connection. Just trying to look at how things are connected and solve that around the board. While I'm waiting for that, it's time to work on the research paper. And of course, coming into it, you say, this is a little bit different from a laboratory research paper where you've got the equipment and you've completed it. This is a research paper just to describe its use in a classroom, the intention of it. So I don't have the customers coming up and saying, oh wow, that's great, and I could say, oh, this is 20% better than this. There's no qualifiable data. It's more a theoretical paper, which is perfectly okay. I think I've written papers, I think conceptual design of a photoelectron spectrometer. It's just, I never got the money for it. The design work, used some sort of maths and quantum aspects of electrons to measure. And so the design and the maths went together and you published it. So this is sort of getting along to conceptual design. And coming up, you're aware of your science literature, you read the educational literature, and you realise the educational literature is profoundly different in that they're not, they're sort of social science citing it, that they cite it, so they have their citing the authority of what someone else said, right? But they're not actually citing the logic or the credibility of what the person said. I'm not saying that people who write things are not credible, except if they're not in that level of being very precise and stuff like that, they can say statements and then you can just read through it and then just sort of cut and paste statements. So it's almost like a cut and paste job that I see quotes and stuff like that to get through, and there's very much a statement that this is a curriculum and we accept that curriculum. Sort of almost a religious concept, a religious document to come through. So it's almost. So they're giving a sermon where they say, I'm quoting from John such and such and such, Jesus Christ said this, the curricula says that, and there's no capacity to sort of go back and say, oh well look, this curricula is one of several hundred curricula gets produced worldwide during the year, and if you go back historically, you can look at the claims made about the last curricula by these people, there's no sort of feeling that you're part of a bigger thing. So that's led to for the introduction, realizing that the introduction's aimed at three different audiences. That's the teachers, the scientists, and the students. The teachers are sort of gatekeepers. They might or might not use it, and we acknowledge that. It's not a sales document. They may or may not use it. They might find this interesting. They might do that. But if it did, so it's a bit like Anne of Green Gables writing. If so-and-so had been at the gate and seen Anne on her buggy going past, they would have thought this. And it's not a counterfactual, but it's something a bit close to it to go past. It sort of steps away from the I don't read science papers. I'm a teacher. I don't get time to do that. This is very practical thing, and this is a way of saying, not lecturing and saying that you should, but if you did read this paper, you would think that's the honest thing you can do. Scientists as an audience, is you've got to make sure that you pull them back and say, look, I know that I am just going to the internet, cutting and pasting technology together to achieve this aim, but the fact that I'm doing this and it's going into this new situation, that's sort of noteworthy, because this is part of a general trend to actually say there. So there's focuses on that, but then when you look at the student focus, there's a series of things that although they may not respond to that, they can respond to analogues of it further down either side of it, and actually so their response for that can be read over or advised for it. So we have this fundamental issue of I suppose critiquing what the syllabus is doing at the moment. So the basically what we in this country are hemorrhaging in science, and by we've got this traditional way of teaching, and we can go forward and get people to recite facts, but then there's nothing that inspires them to keep on doing it. They go off and say, thank you very much, I'm going to do accounting, I'm going to be a lawyer, I'm going to be something else. So the science itself is really dying, partly because there's no it's not being applied, it's not being respected, there's not much happening, and so it's the idea is to get inquiry going, but the inquiry by the actual teachers not being trained in it is sort of very much an addition for it, and they can't generally see the way that they're teaching counters against it. And so leading into that, there's these three areas, I think, which I'm going to try and speak and do, and there's this sort of a mezzanine area to get into it. So the first area is going from the general to the specific, and then how we do that and how teachers inadvertently do that and how that's been the way of learning and applying and modifying so this is very much along those lines. So though we can see a direction from the general to the specific as a fine line, I have a, I think one general principle and one specific example, and see there's a correspondence to it. And this particular product, by producing buckets and buckets of specifics, that they sort of shape the general that you're going to the scope of the of all that's possible. So that's the general to specific thing. So going from the general to specific is deduction, and there's sort of so this is what the human race came up to, that you had religion, general principles, and people would be apply those general principles to extract additional information, to go from the general principle. This is the idea of deduction. So all birds fly, all birds lay eggs, something like that. So I deduce from that general information and my observation that is a bird. It doesn't necessarily mean all that much. Sort of, it's just when you come to think of it, it's just the labeling thing, and how that general information gets there in the first place has been a bit of a mystery. It's sort of just the general information has become there, and you get sort of general life experience. And a lot of people do deductions; deduce or predict. So the entire idea of any sort of science and logic is to possibly explain yourself, to credential the past and predict the future. So to say, well, I saved the kid from the fire, I'm credentialed a hero. Or in the future, you can say, all wood burns, so I'm not going to build a house out of wood, so I'm going to credential. And so it's a very necessary thing. This is deduction. And it's deduction at its height. It was in the Middle Ages curriculum. This is St. Thomas Aquinas, Roger Bacon, that sort of people. They took the general ideas and actually used deductive theories. Now, again, Aristotle, who is sort of the great thinker, was just pushing on the edge on that. So essentially, there's this belief that there's knowledge, general knowledge in the the pub or the general area. There's groups of tables here, and everyone is going through this process of making up their minds, using their general observations to make up prejudiced opinions about various things, and it conflicts. And so the Middle Ages revelation was that you could go to these different tables and see contradictions between these two groups and use that contradictions to as a quality control process, the scholastic process. Now, this is actually not too far from what schools do at the moment. They have their class, and they have the teacher actually sees that people have these ideas, but I'm going to help them by getting them to discuss with each other or show them an experiment, show that it's that they're moving from the general to the specific, and that there are general ideas out there, but they may not have access to them, so that they can actually they may not have heard what the thinking of the other table is. So it's sort of like the general ideas are in the community, but they don't reach everywhere. And so you can sort of diagnose the failures of deduction by this comparison. So it's still very much in the Middle Ages type of stuff. You said Aristotle, who's just on the start of things, saying, oh, well, look, rather than actually just listening to arguments, you have to actually test the arguments against facts. And this is the emergence of scientific thinking. Now, the great advantage of scientific thinking, or the great advance, was going from the specific to the general. And this is inductive thinking. And so this is, I get my specific information, and therefore I shape, I do that as quality control of the general, but also I then say there's things not known in this pub, there's other ideas which haven't come across, and I'm going to code them out by doing this. And this is the process of induction. The critical thing is that the more specifics that you have, and the more they have significance, and they're more linked together, the greater your ability to do a power of induction. So the fundamental idea of this is that this box is a turbocharged method of induction. So rather than measuring a specific temperature, that specific is linked to other specifics. I can measure other temperatures, I can measure other masses, I can see it at the same time. My scope of hypothesis, or guessing what's there, is that now there is this idea of a wild guess, and you go through a process of saying, is that wild guess, is sort of like not Cluedo, but it's some sort of thing where you can say, is it this or this, and you can say, no, it's not that, and so you can finally make a guess on it. Now, so in terms of the way that people think, this has got an induction process, and so, you know, what is science? Well, there's sort of a sort of deductive version of science. You know, there's a definition, and these examples of it. So, science is done by a scientist, things like that. But that it's just the actual mechanism of thinking, and it's actually quite confronting for a lot of teachers who find it a bit difficult to understand, especially when they're abrupt and rude. If they just listen to, and that they're happy with deductive thinking, they will use deductive thinking to dismiss inductive thinking. You know, that they think, well, in general, I'm right. That's you don't fit in with that, so therefore, I'm going to use deductive thinking to think that indeed there is a fault in classifying you as someone who's credible. I don't know, it's rather complicated to get through, but this definitely does play a role in the push, sort of a higher level role in the push for inductive thinking. So if inductive thinking requires looking at the specifics and seeing how those specifics interact with a general, and if you can get parallel specifics to go in forward, you can remove the fact that eliminates some casual causality, or you can actually see the causality between two specifics going to a general. So this is a great benefit to go through. So I don't know how many people will do it. This is also to do with the something called candor. Now, I must admit, this is so you behave in such a way that you can't be drawn into another set of beliefs. And I've really encountered this. This is another point. I encountered this in the in intellectual property. Also, I suppose, in legal stuff, in that although you could act in a way in that you could be deceptive, but there's a point in time where you say the general idea that it's okay to deceive someone, that's not correct. So, say if you're making a representation to a patent attorney, and you are trying to make it hard for that patent attorney. You're banking on that patent attorney not looking at something. That as an example means that your whole thing is unsafe. So say that you may be putting up this patent. There's an area that you know which isn't that novel, and so you don't declare it in prior art. And there's three aspects you don't declare in prior art. They only have to find one aspect you don't declare in prior art, and they can kick it out due to lack of due candor. And there's sort of a similar type of thing. So if obviously due candor is not good in competitive sport. Where you're all playing a card game, you can't be playing poker and saying, "Due candor, I have to show you my cards." It's like there's social situations where it goes cross, and it's sort of attitudes that you can't be in Parliament and own a business that you're doing it. You can't be. Be seen. And so in science there's this disinterest and like you have a disinterest in your result. So you are reporting results as if you didn't have interest in the actual result. Obviously you do have some interest, so you wouldn't be doing it, but there's no thought that you would be selective or things like that, and there is no thought. There's also the thought that you don't know things, and this evolution of due candor really came out with Nicolas de Cusa, who said a learned ignorance that I have to be aware of my ignorance, aware of my limitations, aware of things. And I don't think this due candor works very well in a competitive teaching environment where some teachers are, you know, "I'm good, let me tell you about my past." It's all very interesting, and it may be a contradiction for here. So this in terms of due candor is that here's a device, and it just reports without fear or favour everything to the internet, and I use it. I can hand it to the student, they can take it home and they can use it. There's that sense of due candor. Now, one of the aspects that I find missing in the science teaching, they sort of teach, you know, science is in a science magazine or science is in the science section of the newspaper. You've got the aspect of science being, the goal of science is to generate new, credible, more science. It's something which is only getting bigger. It's evolving. That's one aspect, and this is the deduction produces more information, whereas induction produces more scientific knowledge. There are new theories, generation of a new theory. But there's that process. There's the candor process that your scientist is not necessarily an egotist, or they can be, but there's sort of these natural things. So, and this was really brought out even in Francis Bacon's first description of scientific society. He sort of sense of selflessness is there. I don't know. I can see how that goes through. Now, there's the other aspect of actually the idea of, I suppose, something, being able to present something that is acceptable that all ideas require it to be simple and understandable and accessible. I don't know. You come across this belief system that everything must be acceptable. Now, in this example, there's these obstacles to getting explained. One is that you've got these different stakeholders going through. You've got these people who are asked to listen to the principle of induction and to be sceptical, to show due scepticism of the syllabus which they're getting across. So just as a thing to put syllabus in its place. Syllabus, the word, is a misspelling from the Middle Ages. A monk misspelt the word table of contents in Greek, and this other person said, "What's that new word?" And they said, "That word is syllabus. It sounds like table of contents, but it's not. It's something special." And it came across. So it's that skepticism which is truly scientific. You say you don't overclaim things, and in modern times you realize that this is just one technological point. Given what we know previously, our justification for taking this next step is this trend we're on that's advise me to do this, but it also, the other aspect of it, it advises me that this trend's going to continue, so what I present here will evolve onto something else, I'm sure. So you can't really you can't use a trend without losing. You can't play the trend game without losing it. But so you've got these people who are very prescriptive and they require the end product to be done. It's so much so that, say, a lot of things in Australia, they just won't believe this is made locally. They really require it to come from the United States or Britain, because that's, using deductive logic or cargo cult logic, you don't do things. So the cargo cult is in Vanuatu in the United States. In World War II, rolled up, these people really hadn't seen anything except the odd British steamship come around the place, and the Americans came across, and there were all these people, and Americans would say, "Look, I'm John from Wyoming, I'm John from Idaho, I'm John from Alabama." So the cargo cult believed in this person called John Fromm, and believe that the concepts would be dropped. And of course, that's very much what we technologically have here. We believe now, with a cargo cult, that Apple will come up with the next iPhone and it will be dropped in, and people will do this. It's actually quite meaningless technological, a lot of discussion about technology when they don't fully understand it. I get across the flip side of the coin is that if you have to just write something which gets through it. So I'll put more hours into it and continue to work through it. So in summary here, I'll do the summary here. There's inductive thinking, there's candor, and then there's the ability to actually interact with a report which is a research report. So it's not a product report, it's not a success report. It's basically saying we're up to this stage, this is what we're trying to communicate, and this is where it's at. And no it doesn't make these claims. It is indeed a research report. You may not have read them before, and they're normally internal things, but in, you know, like you will have, say, you know, research organisation research reports written. They don't get published, partly because the research report would be given across to another institute, and they would say, oh, well, we will, you know, there's this competition. But this is a little bit different in that the research institution is really a global, got a global reach. And I'm going to try and write it up and keep on just engineering little bits and pieces together. And what may happen is that a research report in generally does not have a wide readership. It's got specific readership for people involved in the research process to go ahead. But there's this sort of really nutting through some of the inductive logic versus deductive logic, and this research report maybe sit down there. I don't know, be able to write a much more pithy one by saying, oh, look, we want to essentially inquiry the sort of. It's a two-sided coin. It's a two-step thing. It's curiosity plus induction. So curiosity is great. Volition, these various things, and deduction. Now, if you can actually create something which is better than induction, you can possibly go down this path. So in terms of the evolution, I'll write out this research report, and I'll probably write it in a much more succinct, reason document, and to go across. I'll use this now, and I'll start reading from Wonders of the Night Sky. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.